Nice on the weekends. Cozy, right? My chest constricts. She eases back. There's panic behind her expression. Why? She's annihilated my one chance to ever have Jeb's friendship to myself again. She's won everything. Wow, you really thought you had a chance, huh? Taylor taunts. Just because he asked you to pose for a few sketches, that doesn't mean he's hot for you. My jaw drops. Jeb's never asked me to pose for anything. There were times he had his pencil and sketchbook out while we were together, but I never would have guessed he was drawing me. His art is all about death and tragedy, so of course he likes your mortician style. It's not a compliment. Don't delude yourself that it is. I'm too stunned to respond. We both care about him. Her voice softens, and it's apparent that for once she's being sincere. But do you care enough to let him do what's best for him? He has way too much talent to get stuck babysitting you for the rest of his life like your poor dad. Don't you think that would be a colossal tragedy? The urge to scratch out her eyes boils in my veins. At least I have a dad who cares enough to be there. The words shoot out like poison arrows. Her wounded expression makes me regret them instantly. The doorbell chirps, and the scent of espresso wafts in. Oh, fark. Jen evil-eyes Taylor as the door slams behind her. What are you doing here? She stops next to me, setting down a croissant and a fruit smoothie. Taylor clears her throat, and her mask of nonchalance drops back into place. Alyssa and I were just discussing London and why she won't be welcome to stay with Jeb and me. She snatches up her bag. It stinks here in the land of the dead. I'm out. The minute she's gone, Janara turns to me.
One of these days, she's going to slip up and show Jeb her ugly side.
I pluck at the edge of my croissant. She's why he didn't want me to go. He didn't want me getting in the way of them. Twisting her fishnet tights with a pen, Jen doesn't answer. Why didn't you tell me? Her eyes fill with regret.
I just found out about her going this morning, and I didn't know how to tell you when you came in. You've got so much crap going on with your mom.
Folding my Wonderland notes, I study the blank computer again. What does it matter that the website's gone? Jeb doesn't have my back anymore, and will never have what we once did.
Al?
The sobs I've been smothering since my fight with Dad gather in my chest. They burst like 1,000 acidic bubbles, silently eating away at my heart. But I refuse to cry.
Come on, Jen nudges. If anyone can convince him to give her up, it's you. Tell him already. Tell him how you really feel.
I think of Jeb's amazing paintings, of all the things he can be if given the opportunity. He doesn't need any more emotional baggage to hold him back, and I've got enough to sink an oil tanker. Besides, I can't bear to have him turn me down to my face. He's already chosen Taylor over our friendship. I tuck my notes into a skirt pocket. Nothing to tell. I crushed on him when we were in sixth grade, so it doesn't count. She starts to say something, but I shut her down. And you're not spilling either. Pinky swears are forever. A worried wrinkle appears on her forehead as she gathers her prom dress and makeup.
This isn't over.
It is. Jeb's made his choice. Shaking her head, she leaves. The instant the door closes, I turn to the crow. The emo guy stares back, his eyes bleeding black tears as if he knows my pain. I have the strangest longing to be in his arms, wrapped up in leather.
I'm waiting inside the rabbit hole, love. Find me.
His gaze burns the challenge into my soul like a brand. Startled by our deepening connection, I step back and topple the pen holder with my elbow. A pencil rolls off the counter in front. I walk around to pick it up, and I'm surprised to see Taylor's purse on the floor. She was in such a hurry to leave, she forgot to get it. I fight the urge to toss her things out into the street. Instead, I lift the purse's straps to store it under the counter until she comes back. One half of the zipper gapes open, revealing a huge wad of cash. Almost in a daze, I dig out the money, unrolling the lump of 20s and 50s. There's over $240. If I added it to my savings at home, I'd have enough for a one-way ticket to England with a little left over for a fake passport and expenses. Then all I'd have left to do is find an address for the sundial. It wouldn't be the first time we owed the Tremonts a debt. In fifth grade, Dad took out a loan from Taylor's father to help pay Allison's medical bills. That was how Taylor learned about my ancestry to Alice Liddell in the first place. So in a way, this is justified compensation. Taylor's payment to me for all the years she made my life miserable. My fingers quiver as I shove her gutted purse into the bottom of the trash can, piling papers on top. I reach under the counter to grab the air freshener and slide it, along with the money, into Persephone's tome on mystical crystals. The book has an elastic band sewn into the binding that holds the pages shut. I turn to the poster again. The darkness behind the guy's eyes seems to be driving everything I do, and there's nothing to pull me back from the brink this time. No mother, no father, and definitely no Jeb. Not even his smile could save me now. Chapter 5. Treasure. Once Dad and I get home, I add the stolen stash to my savings in a small pencil box secured with a rubber band and hide it behind my Cheval mirror. Plugging my phone in to charge, I text Hitch to meet me outside Underland around midnight and tell him why. He's the only one I know who can make a fake passport. I still can't believe I took Taylor's money and hid her purse. But like Dad said, we'll do whatever it takes to get Allison home. Thinking about how lit Jeb would be if he knew I was meeting Hitch in the dark alone makes me all the more determined to follow through. A low rumble shakes the windows, and rain pelts the roof as another storm closes in. Spreading a palm along my aquarium's cool glass, I search the back and flip on a soft bluish light. Aphrodite and Adonis perform a graceful dance, entwining their long bodies. On my way to check my bug traps in the garage, I cut through the living room. Dad's there, sitting in his recliner while staring at those giant daisies Allison applique all over the arms and back. He sobs. I want to hug him and make up for our fight. But when he sees me watching, he claims to have something in his eye and leaves to pick up burgers for supper. Dust motes drift in the amber glow of the floor lamp beside his recliner. The weird lighting, coupled with the dark paneled walls, gives the living room a strange aura, like an aged sepia photograph. Photographs. Why did Allison say that about pictures? How people forget to read between the lines. I stand there, a few feet from the recliner, while everything she babbled skates along my mind like pebbles cast into an endless well. One keeps rising back to the top. The daisies are hiding treasure. Buried treasure. The explanation is staring me in the face. It has been for years. I drop to my knees in front of the recliner, crumpling the layers of netting and lace beneath my miniskirt as I shove my backpack out of the way. Hard to believe it's only been 7 or so hours since I was at school. So much has happened, I've lost track of time. I pluck at one of Allison's cloth daisies where two appliqued petals curl down from frayed stitches. On a hunch, I slide my index finger between the applique and the upholstery to find a hole burrowed deep into the recliner's stuffing. Holding my breath, I tug at the applique until it's hanging by no more than one petal and a few threads. The dime-size hole stares back, too perfectly round to have been accidental. All this time, I thought she'd sewn the patches on to cover threadbare places. All this time I was wrong. Digging into the torn upholstery, I pull out stuffing until I hit something tiny, hard, and metallic. I trace the object, following a round shape that stretches to a long, thin leg with grooves and teeth. A key. My forefinger drags it to the hole's opening and tugs it out. An attached necklace chain coils on the cushion like a snake. The challenge from the website comes full circle. If you wish to save your mother, use the key. Maybe I should be freaked out, but I'm thrilled to finally have tangible proof that Allison is trying to tell me something. That her babbles weren't babbles at all. They were coherent clues. Tapping the cold metal with a fingertip, I imagine what the key might unlock. I've never seen one like it. So intricate, with strips of burnished brass interwoven like ivy. It looks old. Antique even. As tiny as it is, it might open a diary. I loop the necklace around my neck and tuck it under my shirt. Allison said daisies, plural. Could there be other things behind the rest of the appliques? Inspired, I disregard the fact that Dad could come back at any minute. I don't even stop to consider the consequences of ripping apart his favorite chair. He keeps a Swiss Army knife on the side table for opening mail. I flip the scissor attachment out, then snip all the daisies in half and gouge out the holes beneath. Batting snows around me. Soon I'm sitting at the foot of the recliner with a small trove of Wonderland-related objects. An antique hair clip, more like a bobby pin actually, with a ruby teardrop attached to its bent end, a feather quill, and a Victorian fan made of white lace and matching gloves scented with talcum and black pepper. I suppress a sneeze and push aside two snapshots of my great-great-great-grandmother Alice in favor of the small book I also found. I stroke the tattered paperback's cover and study the title. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. Across the word Alice, Allison's name is scrawled in red marker. She wanted me to find these treasures. Something here is supposed to discourage me from going to the rabbit hole. Instead, I'm convinced these things can help fix Allison, help me break the Liddell curse for good. Tucked within the novel's front cover is a tourism brochure for the Thames Sundial Trail in London. On it is a statue of a child balancing a sundial on his head. I sit back in disbelief. It's the one I saw earlier in my mind. The one the children were playing beside. Allison must have looked for the rabbit hole when she was younger. She must have traveled to London on her search. Where else could these keepsakes have come from? More important, what made her stop looking? The statue is dated 1731, long before Alice Liddell's birth, so it would have been in place when my great-great-great-grandmother was little, which means she could have fallen into the hole beneath it. I now have an address, but according to the brochure, there's no public access to the grounds. Tourists are only allowed to look at the sundial statue from behind iron railings. Even once I get there, I'll need a miracle to sneak in and explore the sundial up close. I slide the brochure back into place in the book, skimming the story I know so well. It's full of black and white sketches. There are a few dog-eared pages and some excerpts underlined. The walrus and the carpenter poem, Alice's tears causing a flood, the Mad Hatter's tea party. Allison's handwriting fills the margins. Notes and comments and different colors of ink. I touch them all, saddened we never sat down together, book in hand, so she could explain what everything means.
Most of her editions have blurred, as if the pages got wet. I stop at the illustrations of the Queen and King of Hearts, where she wrote, "Queen and King Red. Here's where it started, and here it will end." Lightning flashes under the drapes. After the last page of the story, there's an additional 20 or more pages hand-glued into place. On each, someone scribbled sketches similar to the mutated Wonderland characters on the Moth website. The skeletal White Rabbit, vicious flowers with bloodied teeth, even a different rendition of Queen Red. A fine-boned beauty with bright red hair, black designs inked around her eyes, and gauzy wings. The sketches trigger another vision of the children, more powerful than the one I experienced earlier, because my eyes don't even close. My living room fades, and I'm in a meadow somewhere, breathing in the scent of spring. Dappled sunlight blinks around me, keeping time with tree branches rocking in the breeze. The landscape is weirdly fluorescent. The girl, who looks to be 5, wears a frilly red pajama top with long, puffy sleeves and matching pants that cover her ankles. She sits on a grassy knoll beside the boy, who can't be more than 8. They have their backs to me. Black wings drape behind the boy like a cloak, matching his velvet pants and silky shirt. He tilts sideways, so I catch his profile, but his face stays hidden beneath a curtain of glowing blue hair as he uses a needle to thread dead moths along a string, making the gruesome equivalent of a popcorn garland. His feet, snug inside black hiking boots, are propped on a set of sketches, the same ones glued inside Alice's Wonderland book.
There.
His young, soft voice rustles like feathers on the wind. Without looking up, he points to the picture of Queen Red with his needle. The line of dead moths trail it, flapping with the movement.
"Tell me her secrets."
The girl wriggles her bare feet, pink toenails glistening in the soft light.
"I'm tired of being in Wonderland,"
she mumbles in a milky voice of innocence.
"I want to go home. I'm sleepy."
"So am I. Perhaps if you didn't fight me in the air during flying lessons," he says, a Cockney accent becoming apparent, "we'd both be the better for it."
"It makes my tummy kick when we get so high."
She yawns.
"Isn't it bedtime yet? I'm getting cold."
Shaking his head, the boy prods the picture one more time.
"First their secrets, then I'll take you back to your warm bed."
The girl sighs and captures one of his wings, winding herself up in it. Warmth and comfort surge through me, mirroring what she must feel. She burrows into the satiny tunnel, wrapped up in the scent of him, licorice and honey.
"Wake me when it's time to leave,"
she says, her voice muffled. Eyes still hidden behind his wild hair, he laughs. His lips are well-shaped and dark against his pale skin, his straight teeth shiny and white.
"Sneaky deaky, Trixie love."
He tugs his wing free, leaving her cold and pouting. He drops to his belly on the ground. His wings spread on either side like puddles of glimmering black oil as he leans over the pile of moth corpses. After stabbing one through the abdomen, he slides it into place behind the others on the string. The girl watches, fascinated.
"I want to stab one."
He lifts a hand and 5 fingers splay out, white, graceful, and long.
"Give me 5 secrets, and I'll let you string a moth for each one you get right."
Clapping, the girl grabs the Queen Red sketch and lays it in her lap.
"She likes ash in her tea, still glowing with embers."
The boy nods.
"And why is that?"
Her head tilts as she's thinking.
"I
can't explain how,
but I know the answer. I bite my tongue, waiting to see if the girl guesses, rooting for her. Lifting his line of corpses, the boy teases.
Looks like I shall finish this alone.
She hops up, feet stomping the lime green grass.
Oh, the ash is for her mommy. Something about her mommy.
Not good enough, he says, and stabs another moth onto his needle, the pile beginning to dwindle. He smiles wickedly. Her frustration is tangible. He chides her like this often, pushing her until she pushes back. But there's another side to him, one that's encouraging and patient, because I can sense her affection and respect. He threads another moth, clucking his tongue.
Shame you'll not get to help. I think you're too much of a baby to hold a needle anyways.
She growls,
am not.
Tired of his arrogance, I shout the answer. The hiss of steam when the embers snuff out in the tea. It comforts the queen, reminds her of her mother's shushes when she would cry as a baby. Both children snap their heads in my direction, as if they heard me. The girl's face is exposed, a vivid reality. She's me, a dead ringer for my pre-kindergarten school picture, missing front tooth and all. But it's his face, the boy's familiar black eyes leaking ink, that lands me back in my living room on my knees, the meadow vanishing from around me. I'm numb. Is it possible? These aren't memories of some movie I watched. They're memories I made. If I had that memory trapped inside me, what else happened to me that I can no longer remember? Have I actually been to Wonderland, spending time with some netherling creature? I inhale a ragged breath. No, I've never been there. My finger traces the lines of Queen Red's flaming hair on the sketch. If I've never been there, how did I know about the queen and her mother? How do I know she was lonely as a young princess after her mother died, because the king couldn't bear to spend time with her for her resemblance to his dead wife, and her sadness when her father remarried because he had to, since queens rule Wonderland? I know these things because he taught them to me. The winged boy. British. I'm reminded of the voice I heard in my head at work, along with the poster and the guy's bottomless, bleeding black eyes. His challenge resurfaces in my mind.
I'm waiting inside the rabbit hole, love. Find me.
Love. That's what the boy called the girl, what the boy called me, in my resurfaced memory. It's the same person, or creature, but he's older now, like me. I suddenly feel like I've been missing him for years. My emotions scramble in two different directions, a heady mix between terror and yearning, making me dizzy. The doorbell rings, crashing me back to the present. Dad's garage door opener has been on the fritz. It has to be him. I stand. Stuffing covers the floor. Cottony fluff oozes out from the holes in the chair's upholstery. It looks like one of those toys that squeezes Play-Doh through strategically placed orifices. The doorbell rings again. I drag stuffing out of my hair. How will I ever explain what I've done to the recliner? Mind racing, I hide my findings inside my backpack, making a spontaneous decision to take it all to London. Then, considering the violent Netherrealm creatures I saw online, and the black-eyed winged boy who is somehow a part of my past, I drop Dad's army knife in, too. After setting the bag aside, I stumble to the door and unlatch the lock, glancing over my shoulder at the mess. As I open the door, Jeb steps up onto the porch, shoving his phone into his tux's jacket pocket. I struggle to maintain a calm appearance. Hey.
Hey,
he says back. Lightning slashes the clouds behind him. The flash casts shadows of his long lashes across his cheeks.
A gust of wind carries his cologne to me.
Maybe he's here to apologize. I hope so, because I could use his help right now.
We need to talk,
he says. The sharpness in his voice pulls my defenses up instantly. He towers over me at the threshold. Despite the tuxedo, he's still grunge, all the way from his unshaved chin to the bandana cinched around his left biceps. His ribbed white tank and weathered black combat boots in lieu of a dress shirt and shoes help complete the look. Paris Hilton of Pleasance High is going to have a hissy when she sees his wardrobe enhancements.
Shouldn't you be on your way to the Powder Puff Ball? I ask, cautious, trying to feel him out.
I'm not driving.
Translation: Taylor's picking him up in the family limo and is running fashionably late. He grinds a knuckle into the door's scrollwork, his jaw working back and forth. He's ticked about something, all right. What could it be? I'm the one who deserves an apology. A groveling, in fact.
Can I come in?
Red sparkles under his lip, where a brand new garnet lebray catches the light. The mystery of the bag from the jewelry store is officially solved.
How adorable, I mock. Taylor gave you lip jewelry, and it's sparkly.
He nudges the piercing with his tongue.
She's trying to be diplomatic.
Anger rises in a white-hot surge as I remember London and all the things Taylor said to me. Of course she is, because she's 8 kinds of wonderful and that's just her legs. Jeb furrows his brow.
What's that supposed to mean?
Taylor has all the diplomacy of a black widow spider. Garnet's her birthstone. You're wearing her birthday on your lip. Talk about spinning you up in her web. He looks down at me, frowning.
Cut her a break. She's had a bad enough day. She lost her purse with some money in it.
Pausing, he traces a finger along the door's frame.
The last place she remembered having it was at your store, but she figured you would have contacted her if you'd found it. You didn't see it, right?
I push down the guilt nudging me. No. And I'm not Her Royal Majesty's purse keeper, FYI.
Seriously, Al. A little compassion, okay? Didn't you hurt her enough already?
I hurt her?
Rubbing it in her face that her dad doesn't care like yours does. You don't understand what it's like. Your dad, you're so lucky to have that. Neither of us ever did. You know she's sensitive about it. That was cold.
Speaking of cold, my blood turns to ice. I'm dying to tell him what she said to prod me into being so vicious, but I shouldn't have to. There was a time when he trusted me enough to take my side over anyone's without question. Now he's always trying to make Taylor and me play nice. But I'm not the one with the problem, other than being a liar and a thief. Everything presses down on me. The weird discoveries, my busted-up friendship with Jeb, and my damaged family. I feel like I'm smothering. I try to slam the door. Jeb's foot intercepts it. I jerk clear as the hinges swing open. His palm rests on the knob so I can't try to shut him out again. Rain droplets glisten along his sleek hair, which no doubt took gallons of glaze and hours to perfect. It's the one part of his appearance Taylor will actually approve of. As for me, I favor the messy look. Hair out of sorts, body slicked in sweat with motor oil or watercolors splashed across his olive skin. That's the Jeb I grew up with. The one I could count on. The one I've lost. I harden my glare and my heart. If that's why you came by, to bite my head off about hurting your perfect girlfriend, consider it done.
Oh, no. I'm not even warmed up. Jen texted me. She heard from Hitch. I guess he's not as bad a guy as we thought, because he was wondering what kind of trouble you'd gotten yourself into. Why you need a fake passport tonight.
My throat shrinks. I want to slip beneath the cracks in the linoleum. I can't do this now.
I mutter. When else would be a good time? Maybe you can text me when you're on the plane.
I turn around, but he follows me into the entryway. Rounding on him before he can cross into the living room, I fold my arms over my bustier, trying to subdue the urge to punch him. You can't come in without an invitation. He leans a shoulder against Allison's framed photo of a wheat field at harvest.
That's so?
His boot heel nudges the door behind him, shutting out the storm and the scent of rain.
Last I checked, I wasn't a vampire,
he says, his voice low. My fists clench tighter, and I step backward onto the line of carpet that borders the edge of the living room. You sure have a lot in common with one.
Because I suck?
More proof. You just read my mind. I ease one hand up to grip the key hidden beneath my t-shirt. Jeb reaches for my other wrist, wrinkling my fingerless glove as he pulls me back into the entryway with him, close quarters with my fluffed-out miniskirt rustling against his thighs.
If I could read minds, I would know what's going on in your head to even consider traveling to a foreign country alone in the middle of the night without telling anybody.
I try to break free, but he's not having it. Hitch is a tool. I said I wanted a fake ID, not a passport. He got them confused. Jeb releases me, but there's still tension between his eyebrows.
What would you need a fake ID for?
That fluctuation in my head comes alive, lapping at my skull, teasing me to push Jeb's buttons and watch him squirm. To hit a few bars and pick up guys, live a little, get some life experience. You know, so I'll be ready to go to London in time for your royal wedding to Taylor. The venomous outburst has the desired effect. Jeb's expression changes to something fierce yet fragile, like a mix between hurt feelings and wanting to strangle someone.
What's going on with us?
I shrug and stare at my boots, pushing down the prodding sensation inside me. Rain patters against the windows, expanding the bubble of silence between us. I turn to escape into the living room, not even caring about the state I left it in. Jeb's on my heels. It's like I'm the white rabbit trying to outrun time. He catches the tail of my petticoats and spins me to face him. His expression stiffens as he sees the recliner over my shoulder.
What happened to your mom's patches?
He grasps my arms.
Wait, did something go wrong at Souls today?
I shake free and hold my hands in front of my stomach to ease the rocking sensation. Allison had a setback, a big one. Jen didn't tell you? His study of my face intensifies, taking in every feature.
She was in a hurry. Just got the text about Hitch. Is your mom the reason you're acting out?
My cheeks flame. Acting out. Like I'm a preschooler having a meltdown. If he could see the things going on inside me right now, he might actually have the sense to be scared. It finally hits me head on. How close to insanity I'm teetering. The madness behind the things I'm starting to believe. I shiver. Jeb opens his arms.
Come here.
I don't even hesitate. I let myself fall into his sturdy arms, hungry for one taste of the ordinary and sane. He guides us to the couch without breaking my desperate hug, his arms around my waist, my feet resting on his boots like we're waltzing. I breathe in his chocolate lavender scent until I'm drowning in it. We plop down together on the cushions. I don't realize I'm crying until I pull back and his ribbed tank sticks to my damp cheek.
Sorry about your shirt.
I try to brush off the makeup smudged on the left side of his tank.
Easy fix.
Jeb buttons his jacket, concealing it.
So much for dignity,
I whisper, scrubbing my face dry. He plucks at some stray strands of hair glommed onto the wetness on my temples.
You want dignified? Check this. He fishes something from his jacket's inner pocket.
The prom committee voted for a masquerade theme. Tay bought me a mask.
A masquerade prom? Real original. I force the sarcasm, grateful he's avoiding the subject of the recliner and Allison. Whether it's for my comfort or for his, I don't care.
No laughing.
He slips the mask on, a black satin cutout with an elastic band. Miniature peacock feathers fringe the eye holes and outer edges, making it look as if a butterfly crash-landed on his face. I can't help myself. I snort.
Hey!
Dimples appearing, Jeb gooses me in the ribs. I catch his finger, smiling. So, you're a drag queen gone rogue, right?
Oh, you're going down for that, skater girl.
He tickles me until I tumble backward onto the cushions and he half-pins me. Ouch! I hug my sides where they ache from both crying and laughing.
Did I hurt you?
He stops, hands on either side of my waist. A little, I lie. His forehead's really close to mine, long black lashes peeking through the mask's eye holes. His expression is pure remorse.
Where? Your ankle?
Everywhere. Laughing pains. He grins.
Ah, so are you gonna take it back?
Sure. You look more like a feather duster anyway. He laughs, then peels off his mask and uses the elastic band like a slingshot to send it soaring across the room. It hits the wall and splats to the floor in a feathery lump. Good riddance, we say simultaneously, sharing a smile. This is what I've been missing. Hanging out with Jeb makes me feel almost normal. Until I remember I'm not. I scoot over to put some distance between us. You should go. You don't want Taylor to see you coming out of my side of the duplex. He lifts my ankle onto his lap.
I want to look at that sprain first.
I'm about to tell him it's better, but his strong, warm palm under the bend of my knee shuts my tongue down. Biting my lower lip, I watch as he unlaces my boot. When he coaxes an index finger beneath my leggings hem and gently traces my birthmark, the gesture is so unexpectedly intimate, a tremor races up my shin. His eyes lock on mine, and I wonder if he felt it too. He's looking at me like I'm one of his paintings again. Thunder shakes the room, breaking our stare. I cough. See? All better. Dragging my leg free, I lace up my boot.
Al.
His Adam's apple moves as he swallows.
I want you to put a stop to this hitch thing. Whatever's going on, it's not worth...
He pauses.
Losing an important part of you.
Unbelievable. He thinks I'm such a prude he won't even say the word. You mean my virginity? His neck flashes red.
You deserve better than some one-night thing. You're the kind of girl who should have a commitment from a guy who actually cares. Okay?
Before I can answer, a fluttering sound distracts me. At first, I think it's in my mind, until I notice some movement over Jeb's shoulder. A flash of lightning blinks beneath the drapes in the window, illuminating the hallway. Then it's unmistakable. Allison's moth, huge satiny black wings, glowing blue body, hovers there for an instant in front of the hall mirror before flying into my room. My head spins. No. I say. It can't be the same insect from the snapshot, the one from my childhood. Moths only live a few days, never years.
No what?
Jeb asks, oblivious to the moth, intent only on me.
Are you still going through with it?
My pulse kicks up so loudly in my ears it nearly drowns out Taylor's ringtone on Jeb's phone. You better leave. I push him to standing and herd him toward the door.
Wait,
Jeb says over his shoulder between reluctant footsteps.
He turns to face me at the door.
I want to know what you're doing tonight.
I peer through the drizzle at the white limo in his driveway, considering one last time if I should tell him the truth. I'm going to London to find the rabbit hole, even though I'm scared gutless of where it might lead, of who's waiting inside for me, of whatever I'm supposed to do once I'm there. I have to go.
But Taylor's words from earlier rip the fantasy to shreds.
Jeb has way too much talent to get stuck babysitting. My stomach clenches, and I say the hardest thing I've ever said. You don't have a say in anything I do. You ditched our friendship for Taylor, so stay out of it, Jeb. He steps backward onto the porch, as if in a daze.
Out of what?
The pain in his voice rips me apart.
Stay out of your plan to hook up with some random loser, or stay out of your life.
The limo honks, and its headbeams cut through the wet haze. Before my resolve softens, I whisper, both. Then I shut the door, turn, and collapse against it. My spine digs into the heavy wood. Regret fills my already crowded heart, but I can't let the pain stop me. The second the limo's wheels grind away on the wet asphalt, I snatch my backpack from the living room. I'm ready to go looking for my past. Once in the hallway, I hesitate, drawn to my mosaics hung on either side of the mirror. Something is wrong with the winter's heartbeat piece. The silvery glass beads forming the tree throb with light, and the crickets in the background kick their legs in unison. Their wings rub together, making an eerie chirping sound. Gasping, I squeeze my eyes closed until the chirps stop. Then I look again. The mosaic is normal, still and inanimate. I groan and back away. A crackle shatters the silence in my room. I left the door ajar earlier, and soft blue light radiates from within. It has to be the moth's body causing the glow. I ease inside, both relieved and disappointed that it's just the bulb in the eel's aquarium. Heart pounding, I reach to flick on the main light switch. Lightning strikes, shutting off the electricity and everything goes black. I'm squeezing the doorframe so hard my fingernails eat into the wood. The sound of flapping wings darts from one side of the pitch-black room to the other. My pulse bashes and hammers. Every instinct tells me to run into the hallway, out the front door, or try to catch Jeb so he can protect me. But I heard the limo leave. He's already gone. Something soft swoops by my face. I yelp. Stumbling forward, I skim my palms along the top of my dresser and find my flashlight and click it on. Yellow light illuminates a painting Jeb once made for me, and jars of bug corpses. The hairs on my neck stiffen as I move closer to my cheval mirror. The glass is cracked from top to bottom, like a hard-boiled, crystallized egg that's been tapped all over with a spoon, waiting to be peeled. What was it Allison said about broken glass? That it would sever my identity? Jagged puzzle pieces make up my shattered reflection. Hundreds of miniature plaid leggings peeking out between shin-high boots and red net petticoat at my thighs. Thousands of bustiers draped over another 1,000 t-shirts. Then 100 of my faces with ice-blue eyes standing out from smears of green liner. And there, behind my many heads, fluttering black wings and a soft blue glow. I spin around and shine the flashlight, expecting to find the moth behind me. Nothing. When I turn back to the mirror, a scream lodges in my throat. A guy's silhouette appears behind me in the reflection. The image is distorted and broken into countless pieces, all except his inky eyes and dark, shapely mouth. Those I see clearly. It's the boy from my memories, all grown up.
Chapter 6. Into the Rabbit Hole.
Lovely Alyssa.
The guy's lips purr that Cockney accent I heard at the store.
You can cure your family. Use the key to bring your treasures into my world. Fix Alice's mistakes and break the curse. Don't stop until you find me.
What does he mean, Alice's mistakes? Something she did inside Wonderland caused all this to happen? The weight of my backpack holds me steady as I stare at him, captivated. I'm afraid to turn around and see if he's behind me. Afraid the silhouette and beautiful voice are only figments of a frantic, failing mind. Are you real? I whisper.
Do I feel real?
He whispers back, his breath hot against the nape of my neck. A set of strong hands wraps around me from behind, causing every nerve to dance inside my body. I twist around. The flashlight's glow sweeps the empty room, yet the pressure of knowing fingers still trails across my abdomen. Stunned with sensation, I let my hand follow his touch, from my navel to the band of my skirt. My knees give out. Somehow I'm still standing, as if the phantom guy holds me up.
Remember me, Alyssa.
A nose stirs the hair at the back of my head.
Remember us.
He starts to hum, a haunting melody. No words ride the music, only the familiar notes of a forgotten song. The instant his humming ends, so does the embrace. I sway to catch my balance. Within the broken reflections, the moth has replaced him again. Somehow the moth and the guy are tied together. I should be terrified. I should be committed. But something about the netherling is sensual and exhilarating, more evocative than anything in my world has ever been. I reach toward one of the moth's reflections, aiming for a crack where it's severed in two. My finger meets the glass, only instead of sharpness, it feels like sculpted metal. Repositioning the flashlight, I realize it's not a crack in the glass at all. It's a keyhole, tiny and intricate. I dig out the key from under my shirt, fingers shaking as I take aim.
Tut.
My dark guide scolds, though I can't see him anywhere.
I've taught you better. You're forgetting a step.
He's right. I remember. Envision where you wish to go, I say, using his words from years before. The key is a wish granter, and will open the mirror to my desires. Letting the backpack fall to the floor, I dig out the sundial brochure and study it. When I look up again, it's the picture from the brochure staring back at me from the cracked reflection. I insert the key into the hole and turn. The glass becomes liquid and ripples, absorbing my hand. I jerk back, and the key falls against my chest, suspended on its chain. I hold my fingers up. They look the same as always, completely unaffected. They're not even wet. A crackling sound snaps my attention back to the mirror. The splintered glass begins to smooth, forming a watery window instead of a reflection. It's a portal that opens into the garden bright with sunlight and flowers where the statue sundial waits.
Want it with all your heart.
The command swims in my head, so quiet it's an echo from my past.
Then step inside.
I have a moment of lucidity. If I'm about to be magically sucked into London, I need a way home. I snag my pencil box of money and drop it into the backpack. I shove the flashlight in, too. Who knows how dark the rabbit hole might be? I step forward and let both of my hands sink into the liquid glass up to my elbows. On the other side, a cool breeze meets my arms. Someone strokes my skin, from my elbow down to the wrist,
fingertips so soft and knowing, they light a firestorm inside my veins. It's a touch I already know, yet so different now, no longer innocent and calming. When I look into the portal, my gloved hands appear in the landscape beyond, casting shadows on the grass next to the guy's winged silhouette. Before I can see him clearly, he's gone. I hesitate and think of Jeb. It's almost as if I hear his voice calling out for me from somewhere far away. I wish he was here right now, stepping in with me. But I can't look back. As deranged as it seems, that guy in the mirror is the answer to everything in my past. This is my one chance to find Wonderland, to cleanse the Liddell bloodline of this curse, and to save Allison. If I can do this, I can finally be normal. Maybe normal enough to tell Jeb the way I really feel about things. Taking a breath, I plunge inside. I spin in a haze of greens, blues, and whites, my perceptions unraveling like a roll of gauze. A prickly sensation sweeps in, tiny needles weaving me together once more. I fall backward onto the ground and wait with eyes clenched shut, backpack pushing into my spine. The wooziness passes, and the scent of moist soil and fresh air drifts over me. I blink at a bright sun and blue sky. Weird. If I'm in England, it should still be early morning here, way before dawn. Somehow, I arrived at the same time as the picture in the brochure, the time I envisioned. Blades of grass prickle through my gloves as I push my weight onto my palms to sit up. The sundial statue boy waits a few feet away. Behind me is a fountain, the water flowing along mirrored panels as tall as I am. They must be the other side of the portal I stepped through, because my hair and clothes are damp. A spiked wrought iron fence casts shadows across the garden. I stand, drop my backpack to the ground, and brush speckles of mud from my skirt and tights. The birds chirping and white noise from the flowers and insects sound real. The breeze shaking the leaves overhead feels real. The fragrance of white roses from a bush on the other side of the statue smells real. All my senses tell me this isn't a delusion. My imagination couldn't conjure hands like my guide's, or the song he lit in my memory. A song for which the words escape me, but in some way define me. The melody brings back feelings of comfort and security, like an old lullaby. I concentrate on the white noise. A distinct whisper spins through my ears. Find the rabbit hole. The breeze coaxes a soft fragrance my way. It's the roses talking. I drop to my knees and crawl toward the sundial statue, parting the grass as I go. There must be a hole or a metal lid, something that could hide a tunnel. An ornate rock border and a ground cover of ivy surround the statue's large platform. I start digging through the leaves. White noise erupts as I upset the sacred dwellings of spiders, beetles, and flying insects. Some scatter beneath my fingers. Others light into the air. Their whispers cling like static, leading me. With the touch of a feather, you can enter the nether. I scramble to my feet, then step into the ivy, giving the statue a push. It doesn't budge. The time must be right, or you'll be here all night. Time. I try to recall the Twas Brillig poem definitions. Wasn't 4 o'clock mentioned? According to the sundial's shadow, it's a little past 5. Maybe I have to turn back the clock somehow. I try to force the gnomon shaft to a new position so its shadow will fall on the Roman numeral 4. It doesn't budge either. Maybe the statue just has to think it's 4. I dig through the backpack, dragging out the feather quill I pulled from Dad's recliner. With the touch of a feather. I center the plume over the dial and move it until it casts a shadow pointing to the 4. Then I tuck the quill into a crevice to hold it in place. The sundial still reads 5 o'clock, too, but I'm hoping my improvisation is enough to do the trick. A series of clicks and clatters emerges from inside the statue's base, like latches being opened. Heart racing, I wedge my shoulder against the stone boy's arms. With my heels rooted into the ivy, I use my legs to push and strain against the stone. Rock grates along metal, and the statue tips over on its base. A poof of dust belches, then clears, revealing a hole the size of a well. I drop to my knees. Inside the backpack, I push things around to find my flashlight. Flipping it on, I search the depths below. No bottom in sight. I can't dive headfirst into some tunnel if I can't see where it ends. An overwhelming sense of loneliness and panic wraps around me. I'm not a fan of heights, the very reason I haven't mastered an ollie in skateboarding yet. I love the thrill of the ride, but free-falling has never been my idea of fun. I once went rappelling in a canyon with Jeb and Janara. The climbing up wasn't so bad, but Jeb had to piggyback me the entire way down while I kept my eyes shut. Again, I find myself wishing he was here. I sit up. That stirring pressure inside me comes to life. It assures me I'm ready for this. If reality is anything like the Alice book, she doesn't fall so much as floats her way down. The physical laws might be different within the hole. So maybe it's not how far down, but how fast. I drop the flashlight in. It bobs down slowly, like a glowing bubble. I almost laugh aloud. I take a swig of water from one of the bottles at the bottom of the bag, then I zip it closed and position the pack on my shoulders. Perched on my hands and knees at the hole's edge, I have a moment of doubt. I weigh a lot more than a piece of plastic and some batteries. Maybe I should push in a few heavy rocks, just to be sure.
Al!
The shout from behind makes me scramble. Dirt gives way beneath my hands. Screaming, I clutch at empty air and tumble in. Inside, the hole widens. More like a feather on a breeze than a skydiver, I float, my position shifting from vertical to horizontal. My stomach quivers, trying to adjust to weightlessness. Overhead, someone dives in after me. In seconds, he latches onto my wrist and tugs to align our bodies. It's impossible. Jeb? His arms lock us together, his gaze intent on the slowly passing scenery.
Sweet mother of...
Stuff and nonsense, I interrupt, with a quote from the original Wonderland book. How are you here?
Where is here?
He asks, mesmerized by our surroundings. Open wardrobes filled with clothes, other furniture, stacks of books on floating shelves, pantries, jelly jars, and empty picture frames all cling randomly to the tunnel's sides, as if stuck with Velcro. Thick ivy curls around each item and embeds it in the dirt walls, pinning everything in place. Each time we pass something, Jeb draws me closer, his expression a mix of dread and awe. At one point, I work my arm free and snag a jar wrapped in leaves. I bring it between us and twist off the lid, then stretch out once more to leave the jar upside down, floating alongside us. A dribble of orange marmalade oozes from it and stays suspended as we drift, down, 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 until our feet gently meet the bottom, as if we've been lowered on ropes. The entrance to the rabbit hole is nothing but a pinhole of sunlight up above. We stand in an empty, windowless room, domed and dimly lit by candles hanging upside down in candelabras. The scent of wax and dust wafts all around us. My legs wobble, as if I've been running laps for a week. We must have fallen at least a half mile. We're still embracing, but neither of us seems to want to let go. After a few minutes,
Jeb eases us an arm's length apart and stares at me. Into me.
How?
I whisper, still unable to grasp that he's here. He pales, shaking his head.
I slipped on the porch in the rain. That has to be it. Yeah, that's why I'm wet. I'm dreaming this now, but...
He presses our foreheads together and I make a mental note of every other place our bodies touch. His hands glide up my rib cage before stopping on either side of my face.
You feel real,
he whispers, his hot breath mingling with mine. Every point of contact between us heats to white flame.
And you're so pretty.
Okay. That's proof he's delusional and in shock. First off, he's never said anything like that to me. Second, my makeup has to look like soggy newspapers by now.
The key.
It's a wish granter. My dark guide told me to want with all my heart. So when I visualized Jeb by my side before stepping in, because I wanted him with me, he came through too. I never meant to drag him into this. Interlocking our fingers, I coax his palms from my face.
Maybe there's some way to send you back.
Although I have a bad feeling there's not. Something he said earlier sinks in.
Wait. What do you mean you slipped on the porch? I heard the limo drive away.
Tay and I had a fight. She left for prom without me. I wanted to check on you one last time. Couldn't leave things like they were. You didn't answer the door. It was unlocked, so I... That must be when I hit my head.
I grip his shoulders. You didn't hit your head. We're really here. This is real.
Uh-huh.
He steps back.
That would mean you really jumped into the mirror, I really dived in to catch you, then I got stuck in a tree and had to climb down to find you. Nope, not possible.
This shouldn't have happened, I mumble, wrestling my guilt. Wonderland is my nightmare, not yours.
Wonderland?
He points to the tunnel overhead.
That was the rabbit hole?
Yeah. Allison had clues to this place hidden behind the daisies on Dad's chair. That's why I tore it up. One look at Jeb's face and I know he doesn't buy it. Taking a deep breath, I slip off the backpack and draw out the brochure and treasures. I consider telling him about the moth and my dark guide, but those details stick inside me, an immovable mass.
I haven't had a good look at most of the things yet, I add. But I think they're leading me here. I think the Lewis Carroll book wasn't exactly fiction. It was a real-life account of my great-great-great-grandmother's experiences, with some discrepancies. For one, there was nothing mentioned about a sundial covering the rabbit hole.
We both look at the wink of light overhead. Jeb rocks back and forth,